From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this last week of August, we close out the season with a retrospective of some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. On today's Fresh Air, Rob Forman-Dew. She writes novels about the intricacies of family life. She thought she'd navigated past the most hazardous part of her own family journey until her son told her he's gay. Rob Forman-Dew tells us how she handled one of the biggest surprises of her life. It's the subject of her memoir, The Family Heart. Also, thank you for smoking. Christopher Buckley discusses his latest novel, which satirizes the tobacco industry's efforts to defend smoking. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Some Cuban exiles in the United States don't think much of the reported new rule that Cuban President Fidel Castro has imposed. He's reportedly issued a directive to stop children and teenagers from leaving the island in rickety boats and rafts. The director of one Cuban refugee group accuses Castro of having fake concern. The United States is trying to determine if the new order is a change in Castro's policy. The FAA has released audio tape between the control tower and a U.S. air flight that crashed in a thunderstorm in Charlotte, North Carolina last month. Kathy Merritt, a member station WFAE, reports.
The tapes released today show that the pilots of Flight 1016 knew of the weather conditions, and they heard one wind shear alert issued for a quadrant of the airport about a mile from where they were. But the pilots did not hear a general wind shear alert for all quadrants issued on a different frequency as they approached the runway. The last transmission to the tower was a report that the pilots had decided to abort the landing, that they were on the go.
1016 is on the go. This is 1016. I'm staying on the go so far. Runway head and climb and maintain 3,000. Up to 3, we're taking a right turn now. This is 1016. I'm staying. You're turning right.
The plane turned from the runway but did not gain altitude and crashed. FAA officials would not draw any conclusions from the tower tapes, saying they're just one piece of the investigation into the crash. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Merritt in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Israeli and Palestinian officials have signed an agreement giving limited self-government to Palestinians in the West Bank. The agreement took weeks of intense negotiation. Jackie Rowland reports for the BBC from Jerusalem.
The agreement is a first step in extending Palestinian self-rule beyond the enclaves of the Gaza Strip and Jericho. Education has already been formally handed over at a ceremony last week, and when schools reopen for the new academic year on Thursday, they will be under Palestinian control. No date has been set yet for the handover of health, welfare, tourism, and taxation. In most of these sectors, the transfer from Israeli to Palestinian control is expected to be smooth, since the majority of workers are Palestinian anyway. But taxation could be problematic, since the few Palestinians who used to work for the Israeli tax authorities resigned at the beginning of the Intifada in 1987.
Jackie Rowland reporting. The United States has condemned the murder of a Haitian priest who was loyal to deposed President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Father Jean-Marie Vincent was shot to death by suspected paramilitary gunmen last night. A spokesman for the State Department is hinting that the assassination only makes a U.S.-led invasion all more likely. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 16.5 points to 3,897. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. President Clinton has set up a presidential emergency board to look into the current Soo rail line dispute. The Soo Line Railroad is arguing with workers from the United Transportation Union. President Clinton says the panel has been created to help end a nearly 7-week strike, which is threatening to cripple grain shipments. Soo Line is part of the CP Rail system, a unit of Montreal-based Canadian Pacific. It operates mostly freight trains on about 5,000 miles of track in 11 upper Midwestern states. Nearly a third of its revenue last year came from hauling grain. Signs continue that the IRA is moving towards declaring a ceasefire. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Events this weekend fueled speculation that the IRA is about to declare an open-ended ceasefire. Yesterday, Gerry Adams, president of Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, joined with John Hume, leader of the moderate Catholic Party, the SDLP, in issuing a statement. It said the essential ingredients and necessary conditions for a ceasefire were falling into place. Their statement was greeted by Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds, who said there was now an historic opportunity for a settlement of the conflict in the north. He added that the British government had a heavy responsibility in responding to the situation. The British government had only a guarded response. Protestant Unionist leaders viewed the latest developments with alarm. The Ulster Unionist Party's leader, James Molyneux, accused John Hume of selling his soul to the devil by joining with Gerry Adams. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
France hasn't commented on the latest threat by extremist Muslim fundamentalists in Algeria. They're saying they'll destroy French imports in Algeria, protesting Paris's support for the Algerian government. The so-called Islamic Armed Group says starting at the new year, it will destroy all French products, including cars. Some observers have questioned the authenticity of this latest statement. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News, from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist Rob Formandou's territory is the family. Her first novel, Dale Loves Sophie to Death, was about the world's last happy family. It won the 1982 American Book Award. Her next novel, The Time of Her Life, was about how family members unconsciously hurt each other. In her third novel, Fortunate Lives, she returned to the happy family of her first novel, only to disrupt their lives with the death of the youngest son in a car crash. Now Rob Formandou tells part of her own story in her new memoir, The Family Heart. It's about how her life was changed when her older son, Stephen, told her he is gay. The revelation first threw her into a state of grief, but that was transformed into anger at a society which could discriminate against her son. When her son broke the news, he was a sophomore at Yale, home on a break. This is how he came out.
Well, he was on the phone, talking to a girl I thought he was involved with, a young woman. And suddenly I simply said, I realized there was no sexual tension between them, as you hear between adolescents. And I said, have you been involved with anybody since high school? He was a sophomore. And he looked very irritated by the question, as he should have. It was absolutely none of my business. And he said, there's something I've been meaning to tell you. And I listened for a minute. And he said, I think I might be gay. And a parent doesn't want to hear that because there's a huge range of things that happen to you after you get this information. And I tried to change what he said. I said, oh, you think you might be gay? And he said, no, what I mean is I am gay. And we took it from there. I gave him a hug. He gave me a hug. And we moved on. That was the beginning of a long process. Not too long, but longer than it should have been. Longer than I hope it'll be for anybody else.
It sounds like you have a pretty tight-knit family. But did it make you feel, when your son came out, did it make you feel like maybe you didn't really know him at all? And
absolutely.
Did it change your image of him?
No. It didn't change my image of him, but I think this is particular to each family. I did feel foolish on one level that I had not. This is a person, and along with his brother, whom I thought I knew better than any other creature in the world. I thought I knew everything about him. I don't mean intimate details. I didn't think I knew. I didn't want to know who he was dating, or I wanted to know. I knew what wasn't my business, but I thought I knew everything essential to his happiness. And here was this enormous burden of secrecy he had carried in order to make us happy as parents, and that broke my heart.
You know, you had an image of him as being someone who was just beloved by everybody. He did
Golden.
Great in school. He, I think, was a good athlete as well, and, you know, his teachers liked him. He had friends. And now you suspect that he might have been terribly lonely in one respect.
Yes.
During his school years.
Oddly enough, it was the idea of his high school years that I had the most trouble with, because He was so successful, and I think a lot of his energy was driven into being a summa cum laude graduate of his school and a class speaker and a peer counselor. And interestingly enough, his school will not welcome him back. That was very hard. I thought, will people now withdraw their friendship from him? And it's a testament to him. He's a remarkable person, and his brother is too. It's a testament to both of them that people did not withdraw their friendships from him.
Did you ask yourself if you did anything?
Of course.
That led your son to be gay? Like if you were a domineering mother? Yeah, a suffocating mother. That's a very popular image.
It is, unfortunately, horribly popular. Oh, sure. In fact, I dreamed it. I dreamed that I went into my son's room when he was sleeping, and he was in my dream about 8 years old. And I said, I think I forgot to tell you about sex. But it was very clear in my dream that he didn't need to know this. And I agonized about what might I have done. And then I thought, wait, I've only done something wrong if being gay is wrong. And I had never actually believed that being gay was wrong. I'd never thought about it much. And I knew there was nothing wrong about my son. So I guess maybe really only for about 20 minutes did I seriously wonder if it was something I had done. Because once again, when you say if it's something I've done, you're talking about a flaw. And I really never did see him as flawed.
Is there anything you said to your son after he came out that you wished you hadn't said?
Oh, yes. At one point, I was trying to persuade him to tell his brother, who was graduating from high school that year, and Stephen quite rightly said, I don't want to tell Jack now. It will make his graduation all about me. And it's not about me. And it will also make him very uncomfortable, I think. I mean, Stephen was afraid he would lose his brother, maybe. He wasn't sure, but he thought it wasn't the right time to tell him. This made me feel as if we were conspiring against my younger son. And I said, at one point, I was struggling for an analogy, and I came up with possibly the worst analogy I could have come up with. I suddenly said, well, Stephen, this would be like, it would, for Jack, if he hears this from your friends, I mean, it would be as if, and I was still struggling, and I don't know where this came from, and I said, it would be as if he found out you were, a mass murderer. And I've never seen a look on anyone's face that hurt me more than realizing what I had said to my son. And I desperately tried to amend that. But you can't. I don't think Stephen will ever hold that against me. And in fact, even at that moment, I could see him starting to forgive me the minute I said it. And although he was angry, thank God.
Your son told you after he came out that you could ask him any questions and he would answer them. Were there questions that you asked that, in looking back, you shouldn't have, or questions that you wish you asked but you didn't?
I wish I had immediately asked him, explain to me what this means. Explain to me, is this different, or do you know if this is different? How can I imagine your life? Because when finally I did ask that question, he said, I don't see. He clearly didn't know this was something that was baffling to me and my husband. So for a long time we didn't quite understand what I was trying to ask. I didn't understand it, and he didn't understand it. And finally he said, you don't have to imagine my life any different than you always imagined it. I want what you want. I want to love somebody who loves me back. I want a committed relationship with someone. I have work I really want to do. I don't understand how people work when their emotional lives are in chaos. I want what you want. I want to love someone who loves me back. That's all I needed to know. But I had bought into the whole idea of, and I say this with some hesitation because I don't know that I really had bought into this idea about any other gay man, only when suddenly it was my own son. Every stereotype I'd ever been faced with hit me, the idea of the insatiability of gay men, which is a ludicrous idea that I had never paid any credence to until it was my own child. I don't know what triggered all these fears.
Rob Foreman-Dew is my guest. Her new book is called The Family Heart, a memoir of when our son came out. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rob Foreman-Dew. Her new book is a memoir about when her son came out. When your reaction switched from a sense of grief to a sense of anger at the inequities in society, you and your husband became activists. You became active in a group of the parents of lesbians and gays. And then you started to think, well, maybe you were becoming activists at the expense of your other son. What happened there?
Well, life is very complicated. I mean, I've discovered it's... You know, Terry, I really thought that I was going to get to a place where it would be very calm to be an adult. I'm 47. I've gone through the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement, and I thought, oh, now I'm here. My children are grown. We suddenly became obsessed with this issue, particularly after the Republican convention and the Pat Buchanan speech and various other speeches and remarks, and we became so obsessed. I was phoning people constantly. I was phoning columnists and saying, you've hurt us deeply. I lost track of my other son, and you can't do that. You owe equal attention to all your children. My other son was also a real advocate for his brother, especially until we became such active advocates. And then I think he had his own life going on. He was starting his first year of college. We simply assumed, which is something I've learned never to do, never assume anything. We assumed he knew that he had our ongoing unconditional love and affection. And he knew that. But he needed to talk to us about some things of his own that had nothing to do with gay and lesbian issues, and we failed him for a while. I think we're all learning constantly. We're coming back together. We are back together.
What happened to make you realize that your other son had felt that you were withdrawing, focusing all of your time on gay rights activism?
Well, it was really an awful moment, and also a transcendent moment and an absurd moment. My son goes to college, my younger son goes to college in Connecticut, and he decided to stay that summer after my older son came out and work in at school. He had been working at Wesleyan, and he decided to stay and live with some friends and work there. And he was back and forth. He called one day. I was trying to get ready for a dinner party. It was very hot and sticky. He called from Connecticut to tell me that he had had a flat tire and that he was at a filling station. And I got very cross. I said, well, Jack, you have my car. You're in Connecticut. What can I do about this? Call AAA. And he said, well, that's why I'm calling. I don't have my AAA card. And I was really very cross. I said, well, how could you leave the house without your AAA card? You know, and he... Just suddenly, there was a sort of intake of breath on his end of the line, and suddenly I could hear traffic going by. And I realized he was calling me from a filling station or somewhere probably on the interstate. And he finally just said, Mom, I almost killed myself when this tire blew. You didn't even ask. If Stephen had called, you would have been worried about him. But you didn't even ask. And then he was talking over tears. I burst into tears, and I asked him to please come home. I said, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can say but that I'm sorry. I'm absolutely wrong, and we love you, and I hope you'll come home this weekend. And he did, and we started building again. This is still a rather sensitive issue. I think Jack probably feels that we're overly paranoid, and we may well be. I think even my older son thinks that maybe we could be a little less activist. But once we got involved with PFLAG and were on the helpline, we're getting some pretty desperate calls from teenagers whose parents have absolutely rejected them. They're homeless. They sometimes have been beaten up by their own parents. And these are children, not children, young men and sometimes young women who easily could have fought back. It's very endangering to an ego of anyone to have a parent attack you physically. And unfortunately, this is often one of the reasons that happens.
It sounds like the family you've created is a reasonably happy family,
mm-hmm.
a reasonably close-knit family. But from what I've read about you, you didn't come from a happy family.
Well, that's true. The family, they were all so interesting. The people, my mother and father, were fascinating and quite brilliant. They really weren't very happy married to each other. My father was an alcoholic, which is always a problem, and an entire system of, well, it shapes the family in ways that have now become almost, everyone has been reading about them. But when I was growing up, no one did. This was considered a character flaw. And my father was dangerous when he drank. But I loved both of my parents, and both of my parents loved me. I wanted them to love each other, and I think they sort of did, but they also sort of didn't. It was tiring. I was tired by the time I grew up, and I really thought I would get to rest. Now I don't think I want to rest.
Did growing up in a fairly unhappy family mm-hmm. make you more confident that you wanted a family of your own? I mean, you
no.
seem so family-oriented now.
I know. I think that's probably... it's probably some sort of psychological term. I think it's compensatory family making. I don't know. No, in fact, I was terrified when I was pregnant. I thought, what am I? I don't know what to do. I have no idea what parents do. But it really is a pretty natural thing. And in fact, my parents were very good. They meant to be very good parents. And for the most part, they really were. They were really hard on each other. And I think it was really hard on my sister and me to see them so unhappy, and we felt like we constantly had to protect them. But I think when I realized what was possible, that it was possible to have emotional stability and really to love people unconditionally, that's when I think my life became bearable. I had really thought often about, I had been in really great despair during part of my life, and had not thought actively about suicide, but had wanted to sleep desperately, and twice had stolen pills from my father, taken them, and luckily they didn't work. I wasn't trying to die, I just wanted to go to sleep, because I didn't want to think and have to be responsible or worry or be sad.
You know, you write about families all the time in your fiction, and in one of your novels, a son dies, and it's mm-hmm. you know, obviously really tragic for the family. Did it frighten you to kill off a child in one of your novels? Did you feel like you were tempting fate and something terrible might happen to you in real life as a result of it?
Absolutely. In fact, I had to wait until my children passed the age of that child before I could finish the book. It was awful to write. And I suppose what I was doing was contemplating my worst fear and trying to understand how people survive having their children die, because I see them do it with grace all the time. And I think I wanted to figure out how.
Did you start behaving differently around your sons when you were writing Fortunate Lives? Did you
yes.
start to... What was the difference?
Well, for one thing, whenever I'm writing, I behave... it's very difficult probably for my family, although they're endlessly patient. But I became so protective or so worried about them all the time. In fact, that was the year my older son had gone off to prep school in New Hampshire, and I was working on this book, and I heard a report that there was a sniper at... I was listening to the radio, and it was horrible. There was a sniper at a college somewhere who had wounded or hurt someone, and I immediately, there were no phones in the dorms where my son was at school. It was a phone in the dorm, but you could never get it. So I left, I called and asked him to leave an urgent message for Stephen to call me, and he called, and I said, Stephen, you absolutely must come home if you hear there's a sniper on campus. And he was just, he said, well, okay, I will. I mean, I was just sort of a mad woman about safety. I mean, I was constantly telling them things like, how to exit buildings if fire started. And I think they really got, they were so glad when I was through with that book. And, you know, they both read it, and they both like it. I don't think they quite understand the passion of parents.
You have a passage in your new memoir that I found both very moving and kind of funny, too. And you're talking about all the superstitions and rituals parents will go through when they feel that their child might be in jeopardy to kind of do right by fate.
That's right.
And your example is of a friend who, whenever her child is on a plane coming home from a visit with his father on the opposite coast, what does she do?
She scrubs her entire house. And I know just exactly, she's
what's the point of scrubbing the house?
Well, if she has any fun while her children are in the air, I know she feels that somehow they'll take her children away from, the plane will crash. Because how dare she have fun while her children are in jeopardy? Now, her children are getting older, too. All of us do this. I'm sort of starting to grow out of it.
What do you do?
Well, what I do is wear my opal earrings, which I have on right now, actually. Because one of my children is traveling right now. They're really not even pretty. But my children gave, I was born in October, so opals are lucky for October. I mean, of course they're not lucky. It's a superstition, but, and of course I'm not superstitious, but I'm wearing these opals. I wear these whenever, I've sort of extended it now. It's not just my children. Anybody I love or care about who's traveling, I put on these opal earrings, which when a friend of mine recently flew to Australia was really painful because they're not comfortable to sleep in. But they work. The planes haven't crashed. So I should knock wood now.
Right? So you have to sleep in them, too, to make this work.
Yes, you can't let yourself off the hook. If you're going to be superstitious, you've got to sort of follow through with it. But, of course, I mean, we all know, all of the parents, my friend who's scrubbing her garbage cans with bleach knows that on some level, because she's a brilliant woman, she knows that is not going to keep this plane in the air. But on the other hand, she's not going to take any chances.
Your children are adults now. Do you still feel that it's, do you still feel as scared and superstitious about their safety?
No. No, that really does wear, that wears off after a while. When you see them being competent adults, and they certainly have been competent adults, the idea of your responsibility for their happiness wears off, and in fact, you come together as good friends in a way that I hadn't known would happen. Now that they're responsible and leading lives that I admire and that seem exciting to me, I don't feel quite, although I do have these opal earrings on, don't I? But even so, I don't feel quite as responsible.
Rob Forman-Dew, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It was a delight.
Rob Forman-Dew recorded in May. Her memoir is called The Family Heart. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's it like to represent the tobacco industry and get paid to say that cigarettes are not harmful to your health? Christopher Buckley has created a devastating portrait of a tobacco industry spokesperson in the new satirical novel Thank You for Smoking. We'll talk about his novel and about growing up the son of famed conservative William F. Buckley. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava. The State Department is strongly hinting that a U.S. invasion of Haiti is all the more likely. That was the reaction this afternoon to news that a Catholic priest loyal to Haiti's exiled president was murdered last night. Jean-Marie Vincent is the first church official killed in Haiti since the 1991 coup that sent Jean-Bertrand Aristide into exile. Paramilitary gunmen are suspected of carrying out the murder last night. Without naming them, State Department spokesman Mike McCurry directed a statement at those behind the attack, speaking of, quote, all the necessary means to bring about an early restoration of democracy. On Capitol Hill today came testimony about hundreds of thousands of Americans exposed to radiation between the 1940s and 1960s as a result of a once common medical treatment. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Jim Garrity told the panel he did not make the connection between his teeth breaking off and his chronic runny nose until he read about radium treatments commonly performed in the 1940s and 50s. Like thousands of other patients, a radioactive probe was stuck up his nose for 10 minutes over several weeks to cure an ear ailment. Garrity, who now heads the Submarine Survivors Hotline, has cancer in his nasal pharynx.
There are days I have to walk away from the phone and cry. The stories I'm hearing of death and disability in whole families is overwhelming.
Subcommittee Chairman Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut is calling for a federal study of patients who had radium treatments and may suffer head, neck, and brain cancers as a result. Carol Van Dam, Washington.
An agreement has been reached with the Bosnian government to set up a United Nations guarded area within the Bihać area for Muslims. That should provide the Muslim refugees with enough security to return home. At least 25,000 people fled the enclave after government forces crushed a revolt there. The BBC's Richard Carruthers was in Bihać for the signing of the agreement.
After meeting the local commander of the Bosnian army, the U.S. ambassador to Croatia and the U.N. civil affairs chief announced their plan to encourage the refugees to return. A U.N.-guarded reception center will be set up for 6 months near the town of Velika Kladuša, where most refugees come from. If any returning refugee does not feel safe there, he can leave the enclave again. People will be able to inspect their homes under U.N. escort to make sure they're still fit for habitation. And no supporter of the rebel Muslim leader, Fikret Abdic, will be forced to join the Bosnian army for at least 6 months. Whether the latest guarantees are enough to persuade the refugees will still largely depend on what their defeated leader, Fikret Abdic, tells them to do. He still appears to command their loyalty despite the miserable conditions they're living in now.
The BBC's Richard Carruthers. Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders was in a Little Rock courtroom today as her son was handcuffed and led out to begin a 10-year prison sentence on a cocaine charge. 28-year-old Kevin Elders was convicted in July of delivering a controlled substance. Stock market made another strong showing today, the Dow Jones gaining 18 points to close at 38.98. This is NPR. Asian nations who suffered at the hands of Japan during World War II will reportedly be getting a share of a $1 billion reparations package. A Japanese news agency says Prime Minister Tomichi Miyama will announce the plan Wednesday. Japan's official position has been that the reparations it paid to former enemies after the war should suffice, but Asian governments have been clamoring for Japan to apologize and make more reparations. Among those who have not been compensated so far are the tens of thousands of foreign women who were forced to serve as prostitutes at Japanese army bases. President Clinton has ordered striking Soo Line Railroad workers to return to their jobs. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports this comes in the sixth week of the rail workers' strike.
President Clinton has imposed the Railroad Labor Act, which establishes an emergency board that will try to resolve the 6.5-week-old strike, the longest-running rail strike in 16 years. The act effectively creates a cooling-off period during which federal mediators will try to settle the disagreement. Striking workers must return to their jobs. The United Transportation Union has threatened to expand the strike against every company that does business with the Soo Line. President Clinton issued a statement from his Massachusetts vacation site that says an expanded strike would deprive a section of the country of essential transportation services. Farmers fear their grain will rot in the fields if there are no trains to move it. They say there's too much grain to move with trucks. The emergency board has a month to make its recommendations. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
As the school year began in Michigan today, 1,100 teachers in Ann Arbor walked off the job. Their union is demanding a 10% raise over 2 years, while management is offering 2.5%. The game of hockey is losing one of its superstars for a year. Pittsburgh center Mario Lemieux says he is sitting out the season because of anemia. That condition was brought on by the radiation treatment the 28-year-old has undergone for Hodgkin's disease. I'm Melinda Penkava, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tobacco industry has taken a lot of heat from Congress and the FDA this year. This summer, tobacco public relations experts got a kick in the pants from satirist Christopher Buckley. His latest novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Buckley is only afraid his satire might be outpaced by the absurdity of recent events. His novel was already completed in April when seven tobacco executives gave sworn testimony at a congressional hearing denying that nicotine is addictive and that cigarettes have been proven to cause disease and death. Buckley is a former speechwriter for George Bush and is the author of the bestseller The White House Mess, a satire of White House memoirs. He's the son of famed conservative writer William F. Buckley. When I spoke with Christopher Buckley in June, I let him describe the premise of his novel.
The basic premise of the book is a group of Washington spokesmen for dangerous industries. The hero of the book is a guy named Nick Naylor, who, as you might guess from his name, is the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry. His two best friends are a woman named Polly, who's the chief spokeswoman for the liquor industry, which in this case calls itself the Moderation Council, and a fellow named Bobby Jay, who is the chief spokesman for the gun industry, which in this instance calls itself SAFETY, which stands for the Society for the Advancement of Firearms and Effective Training of Youth, formerly the National Right to Bear Arms Committee. And collectively, they call themselves the Mod Squad, which stands for, not for the TV show, but for Merchants of Death. So it's about sort of yuppie, likable yuppie mass murderers, if you will.
You've said the inspiration for this book came from watching the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour and watching somebody from the Tobacco Institute defending tobacco. What interested you so much in watching somebody defending smoking? People who are paid to defend it.
Their motivation. I didn't know anyone I went to college with whose ambition was to become the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry, or for that matter, the liquor industry or the gun industry. I wondered how, you know, 30-something, 40-something, you know, attractive yuppies ended up in this, doing this for a living. So I, having decided to write the book, I called them up, and I was mildly disingenuous about what my motives were. I said that I told them I was researching a book on neo-Puritanism, which Thank You for Smoking also is, and that I wanted to hang out with them and see what it was like to have to, you know, be in the front lines of the of all these anti-movements. And their motivation in the end turned out to be a little more prosaic than inspirational. At the end of the second meeting with this cigarette lady, I was dying to ask her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Of course, being a sensitive 90s male, I don't talk like that, Terry. So instead I asked her, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? And I remember very clearly she exhaled her lung full of smoke and shrugged, a very sort of sexy Lauren Bacall shrug, and said, I'm just paying the mortgage. And thus was born Nick's yuppie Nuremberg defense. I was only paying the mortgage. So, yeah, it was the motivation that interested me.
You know, I could say that it's easy for you to be cynical about the defense I was only paying the mortgage, since you've got a lot of dough yourself and you don't have to worry about it.
No, no, I'm a mortgage payer, Terry.
But it's probably a real big one.
No, I'm trying to pay it off. I don't like the idea of working for the First Bank of Boston for the rest of my life. That's why I write these books, Terry.
Your defense.
Yes, that's my defense. We're all one way or the other paying the mortgage.
Was it entertaining for you to try to come up with speeches for Nick to defend the tobacco industry with?
Absolutely. It was actually, though I find writing very hard, this was kind of fun to do. There you are. You're the front man for an industry that kills, 435,000 human beings a year. That's just American human beings. And what do you say, you know, when you go on the Oprah show and you find yourself, you know, on with the, you know, the head of the Anti-Smoking Office of Health and Human Services and the head of Mothers Against Teenage Smoking. And then, uh-oh, what's this? A bald teenager, bald down, including no eyebrows. Turns out he has cancer from smoking. You know, what do you do? It's at that professional, at the technical level, it's a hell of a challenge.
Well, I love what you gave your character to do. I mean, Nick is very funny and can think on his feet. So in the middle of the Oprah show, and you just described all the other guests, he asks for a cigarette. You want to explain why?
Yeah, Oprah has just given her introduction where she's talked about the 435,000 deaths per year. She's talked about RJR's Old Joe Camel promotion, which has hooked millions of American kids. You know, more kids can recognize Old Joe now than do Mickey Mouse. She's introduced all the other guests, all of whom are just, you know, fire-breathing anti-smokers. And then the last one is this poor 19-year-old teenager who's, you know, clearly dying of cancer and has had radiation treatments. And then she introduces Nick, and, you know, all the audience is glowering at him. And so what does Nick do? He pulls out a cigarette and asks and says, "Do you mind if I smoke?" And there's this gasp in the audience, and she says, "You want to smoke?" And he says, "Well, you know, I understand it's traditional to offer the condemned man one last cigarette," and that kind of breaks the ice. And the audience actually, one person in the audience starts to laugh, and then other people in the audience starts to laugh, to the great annoyance of the anti-smokers on the panel.
Satirist Christopher Buckley is my guest. His new novel is called "Thank You for Smoking." We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Buckley's my guest, and his new novel is called "Thank You for Smoking." You've watched all the TV shows with all the smoking industry people defending cigarettes. What's the most incredible or interesting defense that you've heard them give?
Well, the obvious defense is that it's a free country, and 45 million Americans want to smoke. It's a legal product. They ought to be allowed to smoke as long as they don't, you know, blow it into your lungs. Believe it or not, there is some good news about not smoking but nicotine, which the anti-smoking movement doesn't really like to bring up. But in fact, there is strong medical evidence to suggest, As I read in that section of the book, that nicotine retards the onset of Parkinson's. Smokers have a 50% less rate of Alzheimer's disease. They have a 50% less incidence of endometrial cancer. Believe it or not, I mean, I guess God made nicotine for a reason, and so. You know, they could sort of hit it on that angle. But that, they can't, you see, because they're a little hamstrung, because you can't make health claims for these things. It would be a little bit ridiculous if they went up before the Waxman Committee and said, well, but look at the evidence about smoking and Parkinson's disease. You know, there'd be loud guffaws from the back of the room. So I guess I guess they're stuck with, it's a legal product. 45 million Americans want to smoke under the Constitution of the United States, under the tenets of Adam Smith. Someone's going to supply them with that tobacco. Why not us?
Did you used to smoke?
Yeah, I was a juvenile delinquent, and like most people I knew, and I started smoking when I was 13, and I smoked on and off. I started to give up, I started to give up in my late 20s, and then I finally gave up on September 14th, 1988, at 11:22 a.m., after keeping watch with at the bedside of a friend who was dying of lung cancer. His doctors told me he had 7 tumors in his lungs the size of golf balls. And without going into details, I can report that it is a pretty gruesome spectacle watching a human being die like that. And a toggle switch just sort of went off, and I've never again really had the urge, even after the second martini, which was when it used to strike.
How much had you smoked before that?
Oh, I smoked Camel unfiltered. So I never really, if I smoked 10 a day, that was a heavy day. The worst consumption was probably when I was in college, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and the 20-page paper on light imagery in Canto 12 of Spencer's The Faerie Queen is due at 8 a.m. in the morning, or you will not graduate, and that paper had to get done. And, by 8 o'clock in the morning, there was a yellow stain on the ceiling above where I had been sitting, and, I'd gone through 2 packs of Camels, and, there was that awful feeling that your lungs had been strip-mined. Well, I don't have that anymore.
May I point out that not a lot of juvenile delinquents wrote papers on Spencer's Faerie Queen?
Well, that was a little later on.
When was the 20s. Transformation?
From juvenile delinquent? Well, I guess technically, once I reached legal smoking age, which in Connecticut was 16, I'm not sure what it is these days. I think it may be 18.
Can we talk a little bit more about your youth?
Sure.
When you were very young, did you share your father's political views, his conservative political views?
Well, not when I was very young. As you know, the saying goes that a fellow who isn't a socialist when he's 20 has no heart, and a fellow who is a socialist at 40 has no head. I was reasonably rebellious, but I didn't have much of a chance to be rebellious. I was shipped off to a Benedictine boarding school run by monks when I was 13. So I spent the glory years of the 60s, while the Summer of Love, Haight-Ashbury, Woodstock, you name it, while that was going on, I was in study hall with monks. So my rebellion took the form of shipping out in the Merchant Marine when I was 17, when I got out of boarding school.
My guest is Christopher Buckley. His latest satirical novel is called Thank You for Smoking. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have about Cuba?
Well, we'll be hearing from David Wellner today, who is in Havana, and who has been down at the seashore talking to people who were planning to set off for the U.S. in rafts, and who seem to have been deterred only, Wellner says, by weather conditions, not by concerns about being taken to Guantanamo. He tells us many say that to be taken to the base at Guantanamo would be just fine with them. They'd get three meals a day that way. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about a utopian community in South America and about the race for governor in Rhode Island.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Christopher Buckley is my guest. Your first novel, Steaming to Bambula, was based on your experiences on a freighter. And I guess it must have been after you got out of school, before college, that you signed onto a freighter as a deckhand, and that became the basis of your first novel. Why did you want to go onto a freighter?
Well, I grew up around boats, and I always thought that shipping out would be the most romantic thing you could do. I'd read Conrad and Melville, and my boarding school, this Benedictine boarding school, was on Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, and it had, though it was a very good school, it had, you know, a boarding school is kind of like a prison if you're 13, 14, 15. And I would see all these freighters go by. And I would go down to the beach and sort of look at them and kind of wish I was, wish I could be aboard shipping out to exotic ports. And a couple of years later, I got my chance, and I signed on as a deck boy on a round-the-world Norwegian tramp freighter. And saw a bit of the world and came back with a tattoo, even.
What did the tattoo say?
Well, I had two tattoos, actually. One was on my upper arm, and it's a full-fledged tattoo with an eagle and sailing ships and flags and all that. And then I had another tattoo on my right hand, which, this being a family radio show, I probably can't say what it said, but it was if I held my hand in the saluting position, the officers receiving the salute would be more likely to be offended than pleased.
You had that tattoo removed.
I had that tattoo eventually removed when I had it for about 8 or 9 years. And one time I was working for Esquire and I was interviewing the King of Spain. And we were sitting sort of close together. And I found his eyes straying to the outer edge of my right hand. And I thought, well, here we're on the verge of a serious diplomatic problem here. So when I went back home, I went to a dermatologist, and this was in the days before laser abrasion, and he took out a shiny scalpel and cut it out, closed it up with 13 stitches.
Well, that must have hurt pretty good.
Yes, it did. Well, you know, what goes around comes around. I'm a big believer in karma, and I guess I just, you know, paid for my stupidity 9 years later.
So now when you salute, you have a scar.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't do as much saluting these days.
Let me just say here that I've just been informed that Steaming to Bambula is really a memoir, not a novel. So I stand corrected. I was reading this great anecdote about you in a Washington Post article about you that said, I think this was in the early 70s, you were coming home from Yale for the weekend or something, and you had dropped acid and came home to find that there was a 60 Minutes crew at home doing a profile of your father, and you ended up getting interviewed for this profile.
I picked the wrong moment to duck into the house to pick up a sweater. Yes, it was. It was an interesting day.
I'd like to know what all of that looked like to you in your altered state.
Well, Mike Wallace's face looked like under two hits of California sunshine. Well, it looked a little bit like Picasso's middle period.
And what was it like to be interviewed?
Well, it was extremely uncomfortable, Terry.
What kinds of questions?
We dropped acid, and it was getting cold, so we happened to be walking by the apartment. I said to my friend, "I'm just going to duck in and get a sweater." So we went in, and I literally tripped over a coaxial cable in the foyer, and I thought, "What's this?" And I looked up, and there was Mike Wallace saying, "Oh, great. We'll put you on next." And so I ran upstairs and found my mom, and I said, I really do not want to go on. She said, no, you have to do it for your father. I said, no, really, trust me. I really don't want to go on. She said, no, you must go on. So, you know, you're 17, your mother tells you to do something, you still have to do something. So on I went.
And what did you say? Did you ever see it back?
Yeah, but you know, it was an excruciating 45-minute interview. But obviously, I mean, the show was not about me. I mean, they were looking for the 5-second bite to the question. You know, do people ever razz you about your dad? And I guess I managed to get through it without drooling. But it was with great relief that I got back to the street afterwards.
What was your father's reaction when he found out, perhaps years later, that you were high?
Well, we haven't really discussed it. I think he's a really wonderfully tolerant and mm-hmm. understanding guy. I mean, he would not have enjoyed it at the time if I had said, "Hey, Dad, I do acid." But he was always a remarkably tolerant, I dare say, liberal dad.
Among the many things that you've written and jobs you've held as a writer, you were a speechwriter for then-Vice President Bush in the early 1980s. What kinds of occasions did you have to write speeches for?
Well, I was I was Vice President Bush's chief speechwriter, or only speechwriter, from 81 to 83. And I wrote everything he said, other than the ones he winged. So there were there would be speeches, there were toasts, there were a lot of eulogies. Remember, his motto was, "You die, I fly." arrival statements, departure statements, just about everything. It was really a great experience. And to anyone who's thinking of going into the speech writing business, I would only offer the observation that writing for a vice president is in some ways a lot more fun than writing for a president, because you actually see them, you travel with them. The Reagan speechwriters that I knew hardly ever saw him. One of them had seen him twice that year, and that was to pass him in the hallway. There are so many layers between you and your principal.
Are there certain things that you felt were cliches, but you felt you had to use them anyways, that you need an element of that in speeches?
Well, I managed to get through my year and a half without ever typing the words, "This great nation of ours." This was probably my proudest accomplishment.
Christopher Buckley, his latest novel is called Thank You for Smoking. Our interview was recorded in June. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our week-long retrospective is produced by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Dan Lachlan. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, How We Die, we talk with surgeon, teacher, and best-selling author Sherwin Nuland. He says the classic deathbed scene is a myth, that we expect too much from a dying person's last moments of life. Also, a talk with NPR commentator David Sedaris. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.